From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made 3 weeks ago when the United States Secretary of Housing and Urban Development was giving a radio interview. The secretary is Dr. Ben Carson, a former presidential candidate and a retired neurosurgeon. In the interview, Dr. Carson remarked that poverty is mostly a state of mind. He said that getting out of poverty is about having the right mindset. Essentially, anyone can do it if they have the right attitude. Those remarks set off a backlash and then a debate about opportunity and attitude. We thought the best way to build on the discussion is to welcome people in our community who work on anti-poverty efforts in various ways. So let's do that this hour. My guests include LaShenda Leslie-Smith, Executive Director of Connected Communities. Nice to have you back here. Also here is Ann Johnson, Senior Director of ACT Rochester at the Rochester Area Community Foundation. And welcome back to the program.
Pleasure to be back.
And Paul Whitehouse is here. Paul's the Executive Director of 441 Ministries. And Paul, why don't you let our listeners know what 441 does?
Sure, and thanks for having me, Evan.
Sure.
441 is a neighborhood community development organization. We're committed to holistic development in the Beechwood neighborhood. And we have a very specific Christian point of view. We started out really with some children's programs, which began in the park on Grand Avenue where School 33 used to be. We've since moved into a center on the corner of Greeley and Parcells. And as the children's programs have matured and are more stable, we are now beginning to move into a more of a development phase for our neighborhood. We just recently opened up the New City Cafe in our building to provide job training for area at-risk teens, and we're looking forward to expanding our community garden to provide fruits and vegetables in essentially a food desert. Our big hope and dream is to someday turn one of the corner stores into a nonprofit, full-service, but very small grocery store.
Very good. So that's a snapshot of 441. LaShenda, why don't you remind our listeners what Connected Communities does?
Sure. Connected Communities is a relatively new nonprofit organization that is also focused in the Beechwood and Emma neighborhoods, a part of the RMAPI, Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative, a pilot area. And we're specific and focused on a holistic implementation model, very similar to 441 Ministries. We focus in on housing, education, workforce, and economic development, as well as health and wellness, providing opportunities for families to live, work, and play safely in their community.
And Anne, the Rochester Area Community Foundation has been at the heart of the anti-poverty initiative, so you sort of need no introduction, but do you want to tell us anything else about what you're doing?
Well, thank you. Yes, I would like to just put it in perspective that ACT Rochester, as part of the Community Foundation, is its purpose is to help us change our culture by being sure as a community we're using data and holding ourselves accountable to move forward. The ways we do that is we have a very robust website that has information on all quality of life indicators. We've worked with the foundation to put out 3 very impactful poverty reports. And then every year we do report cards that tell all 9 counties in the region how we're doing.
Okay. And so before we move on at all here, maybe it's better to hear Dr. Carson's remarks in his own language. So, as I said, he's the United States Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, and he was on a radio program giving an interview when the subject of, you know, sort of the causes of poverty came up. Let's listen to what Dr. Carson had to say about poverty.
I think poverty, to a large extent, is also a state of mind. You has the right mindset. You can take everything from them and put them on the street. And I guarantee you, in a little while, they'll be right back up there. And you take somebody with the wrong mindset, you can give them everything in the world. They'll work their way back down to the bottom.
All right, LaShenda, what do you think about what you hear there?
Well, I think that perhaps there is a little bit of misinterpretation in terms of what a poverty mindset actually is. And I think if you would connect it to hopelessness and to despair and to what people who are impoverished and have been impoverished, let's say for many, many generations, come against, I think it's very easy to sort of say, if you had a different mindset, you can do better. This whole concept of being able to pull yourself up by your bootstraps really needs to be done away with completely. Because the reality is that there are real structures that are in place that keep people impoverished. Now, I would agree that a person who is hopeless, a person who is in despair, a person who has come up against a wall at every corner that they've turned might have the mindset that, man, you know, I'm just not going to be able to do this. And so the question really is, how do we help eliminate hopelessness? How do we help eliminate barriers to get people to a place where they can begin working on goals to move themselves into a different place?
And I thought your personal story that you shared the last time you were on this program, you know, we don't have to do it in the same kind of depth, because I know you've told it before, but I think it really fits in this context. In many ways, people look at you mm-hmm. and they say, well, you pulled yourself up by your bootstraps. Mm-hmm. But on this program, you were careful to say, no, you were still standing on some other people's shoulders too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I like to call them angels, but really it were people who came along. So I was a teen mom. I had my first child at the age of 14. I mean, I don't know any 14-year-old who could raise a child, go to school, work a job, and be successful on their own. And there were real systems that were in place that could have prevented me from being successful. As an example, I did graduate from high school on time because I had support, some family support. I was on public assistance. I received a child care subsidy. That child care agency was able to pick my child up. So transportation, the barrier of transportation did not prevent me from being able to get to school or work. But when I did graduate from high school and was on my way to college, I was accepted into a four-year institution and was advised by my caseworker at the time that my child care subsidy would not apply to a four-year institution, only a two-year institution. Now, hopelessness would have stopped me dead in my tracks. But I was fortunate to have had some supports along the way that I understood at this point that there may be a way to navigate the system. So I went searching, I went asking for help, and my child care provider at the time offered to watch my child for $40 a week while I went to college. I don't know where you can find high quality early childhood development. That's why I called this person an angel, because the system was not set up for me to be successful. Had I not had that opportunity, had I not had that support, I would not be qualified to sit here in this seat and have this conversation with you.
Okay. Well, let me ask Paul Whitehouse, what did you make of Dr. Carson's remarks?
Well, I thought he was like way too general. He has since backtracked, or clarified anyway, I guess you could say, his initial comments. But he did go on to say in that interview, really supporting the very thing that LaShonda has experienced in her life, how needful that is to have these things in place that can come alongside folks who find themselves in that situation and they aren't stopped dead in their tracks. So I really appreciated that. Later on in that same interview, Steve Harvey happened to mention just the fact that not everybody has those straps on their boots to pull up. And I think that's something for all of us to keep in mind, that there are tools that are necessary, and folks for various reasons have not had the opportunity to acquire those tools.
Okay. Anne, what did you think?
Well, first of all, poverty, the definition is a lack of material possessions. So that's how we define it. And Ben then took it to a mindset description. Poverty in the work we've done in these reports clearly is multifaceted. It's so complex. And to have, as LaShonda said, the right hope and the exposure to opportunities is so important, but there are so many other and different things. I think that Mr. Carson, in his position, missed an opportunity to be motivational about the types of things that can help you get out of poverty, as opposed to being judgmental. He even later in the interview talked about, you know, parents teaching your kids to have a win-win attitude. Yeah, we want our children to have a win attitude, but there are many different people like angels and mentors and others, not just parents. So I feel again like he missed an opportunity to be broader in his motivating people that it can happen in the right scenarios.
I want to listen to a couple of remarks we heard from Dr. Pedro Noguera, who is an educational scholar who was recently in Rochester as a guest speaker at East High. He was here with Sean Nelms, the superintendent of East, and we talked briefly about his thoughts on Dr. Carson's remarks. So first, let's get his general reaction to what Dr. Carson was saying.
I would say he's partially right. That is that there are psychological, you know, cultural, social conditions that are associated with poverty. But if you don't understand the way in which our economy creates poverty, that it's structural, right? That is that it built into the way our society has operated historically, we've created certain communities that become obsolete, where there are no jobs. And so no matter what your state of mind is, if there's no job, you're going to still be broke. And that's what he doesn't seem to acknowledge in that quote.
And here's what Dr. Nogueira had to say about this idea of, well, pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
Well, not entirely. I mean, I think positive deviance is an important way of understanding what it might take to enable more people to escape poverty. Both Sean and I have that experience in our own backgrounds. So there are living examples of people who come from poor backgrounds who've been able to use education and experience other opportunities. It doesn't mean that just because we did it, that it's easy for anybody else to do it. And if you don't understand the barriers that are in the way that make it more likely that people will also stay poor, then you're not going to change the outcomes for more great number of people.
And so hearing Dr. Nogueira, hearing especially what LaShonda was saying about her own life, one of the things I'm struck with is this need to have a balance, to not extinguish hope, but to also not treat everyone with judgment, as Anne was saying, to the extent that says, well, if you don't pull yourselves up, then you are flawed in some way, you're not deserving. Because most people in poverty have a real hard road, as Dr. Nogueira says. If there's not jobs near where you live and you don't have transportation, you can't wish yourselves or necessarily just will yourselves or snap your fingers into a better life. But you don't want people to lose all hope. So let me go around the table and ask, and I'll start with Paul. You know, when we have this balance, this push-pull of wanting to provide the opportunity and the structure in place without extinguishing hope, what are we lacking most right now in the work that you're doing that needs to change?
I think for us, we're just lacking folks to come alongside those in need. We have an excellent volunteer force at 441, probably altogether 80 people are involved in our ministry. But the problem is so much bigger than those 80 people. And our focus is simply the Beechwood neighborhood. We're not trying to fix anything else. But we have 9,500 or so people that reside in that neighborhood that have not had any contact with us as yet. So to expand that and to be able to raise up that force of laborers to come alongside people, to mentor, to teach job skills, I mean, all those things are so needful, to provide transportation if necessary. The issue is way bigger than any one organization, which is why we just are absolutely committed to collaboration with community place of Greater Rochester, connected communities. We want to work together to see this problem solved.
You need more volunteers.
Exactly.
And a volunteer commitment is roughly how much time?
It really depends on the individual. And we have folks who volunteer regularly with us every week. And we have other people or once a month. And some people just do one-off projects for us to help us out to free up other people.
So there's not sort of an average snapshot of what a contribution, but you mentioned a few. Transportation, providing transportation. Now, what's just one example of if someone called you tomorrow and said, I'd love to volunteer, put me to work, what would you have them do?
Well, what I would probably do is have them come in and, sit down with one of us on staff, get a better view of our program, our philosophy, our facility for sure, and let them ascertain where they might feel they could fit in the best. Just this past Monday, we started a bicycle repair clinic on our corner in front of our center in collaboration with our community bikes and the Little Flower community, because so many people in our neighborhood, our adults, are dependent on a bicycle, whether it's to go to appointments, get to work, whatever the case may be. So we, just saw a great opportunity to be able to come alongside of them with free bike repairs to keep them rolling in whatever aspect of their life they need that bicycle for.
Okay, so that's a snapshot from 441. LaShonda, what would you say in terms of, sort of bridging that gap of maintaining hope, but making sure the structure is in place. What do we need?
Absolutely. We heard Pedro talk about there are structural pieces that are in place that needs to be addressed, that sometimes that needs to come through legislation. We have this issue of a benefits cliff in our community. People begin making money, they elevate a little bit, and all of a sudden your benefits are cut so drastically that you are not able to maintain the lift that your family needs to have for the loss of those benefits. So those kinds of things need to be addressed. And at one point we did have some programming that allowed for that, and administration has changed and things have changed over time. And if we're not really willing to look at the systemic issues of poverty, we are only going to be able to make a small impact in the lives of a few people here or there. So it really has to be big picture thinking. We have to have our government get involved and really think this through a little bit more than just providing a program or here or there.
Okay. And bigger picture, what do you think?
So from where I sit, I tend to be on the side of the service providers and the businesses, the people who have the opportunity to provide jobs and skills for people. And what I see is we have the awareness now. The reports that have been done, the discussions and the organizations and the community are in place, aware of the issue. We don't necessarily have the understanding. If you haven't walked in shoes of being in poverty, you may provide a job for someone, but you may not understand the supports that are required for the person to be successful and to maintain in that job, because their life is highly stressful. And many of us don't have to deal with the kind of decisions they have. So my hope is that our community en masse will participate in poverty simulations if you haven't been in poverty. A half day of experiencing and seeing the types of decisions that people have to make who are in poverty will help us move from awareness to understanding. And then when we say we need more people engaged, those people will come from a place of at least having the empathy and understanding of the challenges, not the judgment of the pull yourself up by your bootstraps like I did.
And what is a realistic time frame for us to, I think you're a good person to ask this, because when it comes to the anti-poverty effort, you know, Ed Doherty is so wise. Ed says people always ask him, what's one thing that we can change in a year? And he says, well, we can stop asking what can change in a year. You know, that's one thing that can change. You know, like don't expect it to change overnight. Well, it's been, we're a few years in here now of probably a multi-decade effort, though. How are we going to start seeing, you know, real measured difference here, do you think?
Well, we're going to see measured difference in operational environment. So connected communities will move the needle a little bit. Some of the new companies that are coming into the city of Rochester or expanding, like the breweries, they are being funded by the URI, the Upstate Revitalization Initiative, for those people they hire who are in poverty. We need to be sure that when they hire those people, that there's an opportunity for them to be skilled and productive. So to me, it's not we're going to move the poverty needle number for the city or the county immediately, but in different organizations and in every organization, we can move progress. And if people are tracking that, we can then understand, you know, kind of subjectively, not necessarily objectively, the progress we're making.
Listeners, if you want to respond to what we heard from Dr. Ben Carson, the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, regarding sort of the pull yourselves up by your bootstraps mentality about poverty, or if you want to comment on what you're seeing in Rochester or maybe your own experience, you can do that. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Writing for The Hill, Annie Wright wrote a piece regarding Dr. Carson's remarks, and it was titled, Ben Carson is Wrong. Eradicating poverty is not mind over matter. Housing matters most. And let me just read briefly from her piece, and we'll see what our guests have to say about that. She writes that poor people can overcome their circumstances through a mind over matter approach is a dangerous idea that ignores ugly realities. Like a mole, we must whack it every time it rears its ugly head. Of all the barriers that keep poor people poor, affordable housing may be the biggest. Reliable access to a safe, affordable place to live is among the most basic of human needs. Without stable housing, all of the other benchmarks and pathways to the middle class are out of reach, end quote. And what do you think of that?
The first aha I had when I was looking at race and ethnicity indicators on the ACT Rochester site was the indicator of housing in the city by race and ethnicity. And when HUD says you should not spend more than 30% of your income on housing, and in our city we range from 35% to 55% on average, how does a person make that change? How do you get self-sufficient if you're spending way more on your house? Now, that assumes you even have one. You have one that's being kept up by the landlord. And here we are in a region and a community that talks always about we're an affordable place to live. And yet that isn't the case in this particular targeted environment. And so the stress of, am I going to pay my electric or gas bill? Am I going to keep my phone working so I can be in touch? Can I, have a good place to sleep? Those are stresses, especially when you do something like a poverty simulation, that you see just how much that weighs on somebody and impacts their ability to be more productive. Is it the only one? Is it the top one? I don't know that I could answer that with experience, but it's a really important one.
Okay, LaShonda, what do you think?
Yeah, sure. I think to piggyback on what Ann is saying, for those who are on public assistance receiving some sort of housing subsidy, the shelter allowance rate hasn't changed in many, many years, yet the cost of living continues to go up. So people have to make real choices every single day. Do I buy food for my family? Do I pay my rent? Do I pay my car insurance that's going to, get my car back and forth to work? There are real decisions that do cause a lot of stress. And I do think that this is where this aspect of hopelessness that I've been referring to can, that's where that can rear its ugly head and make people feel like they're in despair and there's no winning, that they are just never going to be able to get out of these current situations. And again, to Anne's point, in terms of whether or not it is the most important aspect, housing, I don't know. I do believe that having stable housing is definitely a necessity. I mean, in order for you to lay your head safely somewhere. But I do also believe that it's a holistic approach, and that's what Connected Communities is all about. There is no one thing, in my opinion, that will help to lift a person out of poverty. It's a multifaceted issue, as have already been stated here, and it requires you to be aiming at the problem in multiple different directions so someone can stabilize.
What do you think, Paul, on housing?
I totally agree. In the Beechwood neighborhood, a lot of rental units, a lot of out-of-town landlords using the least probably expensive property management groups they can find. So people are living in residences that aren't well-maintained, and therefore I think that just lends to that feeling of hopelessness that LaShonda referred to, and which is why at 441, a core group of people that are involved with us have relocated into the neighborhood to attempt to bring an element of stability to the streets that we live on, really following after Dr. John Perkins's three R's of Christian community development of relocation, reconciliation, and redistribution. We want to be there. We want to know the needs of our neighbors, and we want to be able to help them find the assets that they already possess to be able to move forward.
But Paul, this is a perfect, I'm going to go to an email I got from a listener named Abby on this, who tells me, she said, I'm sorry, let me just pull it, because Paul's comments brought me right back to what Abby was writing about. She said, Evan, we're damned if we do, damned if we don't here. If we live in the suburbs, then we don't care about the city. If we move back into the city, particularly in stressed neighborhoods, we're told that we're gentrifying and we're a negative force. It seems like we can't win.
I would argue with that to some degree. It really depends on your point of view. I know for my wife and I, we relocated to Garson Avenue from the South Wedge, and probably one of the nicer neighborhoods within the city. But we knew we were called to be where we're at. Several other people have moved into Beechwood from the Browncroft neighborhood, also a very nice neighborhood, within the confines of the city. And it really depends on really what you want to do. I mean, certainly the housing stock in Beechwood is inexpensive, and in its day, those homes were beautiful. And if that's all somebody wants to do is have a beautiful home with nice wood, you know, gumwood trim, yeah, that's the place to go inexpensively. But for us, we want to be able to come alongside of our neighbors who are struggling with whatever resources we may be able to bring to the table and, you know, assist them in really discovering how they can move forward in their lives. We want to see Beechwood flourish.
All right. Well, before I grab some of your phone calls, I want to just kind of tie up this conversation on housing. By number one, we're going to play a clip that is maybe the most played clip on this program since I started here 3.5 years ago, and it's Ed Doherty. And when Ed said this, it stuck in my brain so much, and I didn't want to let this go. And it even came up earlier this week, not the clip itself, but the subject. So first, let's listen to what Ed has to say when it comes to the oft-repeated claim that people have when it comes to affordable housing. Well, come on, you can't tell people where to live. You know, people are allowed to live where they want to. You can't criticize people for moving to the suburbs or moving out of certain neighborhoods. And you cannot tell people where to live. This is what Ed said about that.
We have made sure that rental housing for the poor is concentrated. So we don't have a naturally occurring market reality. We have a reality that has resulted from decades and decades of restricting the places where we will permit the poor to live. If we wanted to find an opportunity in suburban Rochester for 10,000 low-income families, that would be 3,500 housing units, and we found a way of doing that that dispersed it throughout the community, that would result in no more than a 1.8% increase in any single community. This can be done without burdening communities. We're really going to make a dent when we can create middle-class neighborhoods of people who have school children and are integrated. And when I use the term middle-class, that's not a code word for white. That I am referring to integrated middle-class neighborhoods. And that's the kind of strategy that I think is much trickier to do, but is going to have some better results.
All right, so that's Ed Doherty talking about where people live and how we structure, you know, quote-unquote affordable housing and the results of that. And one of the things that I've wondered about since he made those comments probably a couple of years ago is, are we going to see more of a dispersion? Are we going to see the suburbs sort of step up? Mark Assini, who's the supervisor of the town of Gates, called this program earlier this week and said, you know, that they have a new affordable housing location in Gates, I think 90 units. And he had to kind of hand sell it to neighbors. He had to kind of talk to people who live nearby and were concerned about, you know, who's going to live there, where, what's their background. And he said some of what he heard, not the majority, but some of what he heard was racist. Some of what he heard was pretty vile. But he said he hand sold it and said, let's talk about it. And now he said he's got buy-in, but it took that hand selling and he's willing to do it. And he urged his colleagues in other towns and suburbs to do the same. And are we seeing that at all happening?
We are seeing behind-the-scenes efforts to look at how do we engage people. Mark obviously has a unique position to be able to talk to neighbors about it. But there was a housing work group as part of Vermoppy when it started, and Stuart Mitchell from Pathstone is extremely passionate about finding opportunities and initiatives to be able to engage people in communities to do something similar, but from a systemic standpoint, as what Mark did in Gates.
Okay, well, are you an optimist that we're going to continue down that road, that we are going to see sort of diversified communities more?
I think we will keep heat and light on this issue. I think it will be slow to take effect, and I think some communities are more open to starting that process than others.
All right. Well, I'm late for our only break, and when I come back, we're going to get some of your phone calls about people being denied services, more on Dr. Carson's comments. Our listeners wanted to weigh in on that. We're talking to Ann Johnson from ACT Rochester and the Rochester Area Community Foundation, LaShonda Leslie-Smith from Connected Communities, Paul Whitehouse, the executive director of 441 Ministries, as we talk about poverty, the structure of poverty, and what is happening in our community. Your phone calls are next. Coming up in our second hour, let's talk about Paris. President Donald Trump recently celebrated the opening of a new coal mining operation, and he says we are pro-coal, We are pro-drilling, and we are out of the Paris Climate Accord. What does that mean going forward? What does that mean for our position in world leadership, or lack thereof? What about alternative forms of energy? What does it mean for solar and more? That's next hour on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. Let's get to your phone calls. Kim in Rochester, first up. Go ahead, Kim.
Hi. First, I just want to make one small statement briefly, that my mom in the 60s raised four children alone. My father abandoned her. She did have a RBI business background after high school, but she raised us, kept us in the Browncroft neighborhood, kept clothes on our back. It was a struggle. There was a lot of despair. There was talks of suicide. There was small financial assistance from welfare at the time. And then she got her bachelor's. But I think when we talk about poverty and what Ben Carson said, there's a mentality, and she did have a good background in her family life. And that's what they don't have today in Rochester and all over the country. They don't have that structured background of work ethic and to continue doing what you have to do. And there were no programs back then, and I praise the programs today, but I see people walking around the streets in the neighborhood that look like they don't work. When I was a teenager, I always had small jobs doing whatever, and I understand now teenagers don't want to work like they used to, but I think 30 years ago we were praising young women that were not married, having babies and putting them on welfare. That hasn't really stopped, has it? They don't have the mentality to raise their children properly, so this poverty is generational. But I haven't heard the word education once in your program.
All right, well, Kim, thanks. You've given us a lot to think about there. So let me say, first of all, thanks for the phone call. And we'll get to education in a moment here. But LaShondo, what do you make of what you just heard from Kim?
Well, I think there are a lot of assumptions that are being made. When we look at the various programs that are available, let's take youth employment, for example. If we look at Summer of Opportunity program, there are a few hundred slots for thousands of kids who want to work. And so they have to turn kids away. RCSD just started a summer program for kids to be employed. 250 students applied for less than 100 slots. So I don't think if we can make the assumption that if we see someone walking down the street that A, they're not working, and B, that they don't want to work. It's just not the right assumption to have. Also, I raised a child at 14 almost 30 years ago myself and was not by any means being praised, and nor were my peers. It was in the early 90s, there was a significantly high rate of teen pregnancy. But again, I'll speak to the fact that many kids who are impoverished, who do delve into risky behaviors, oftentimes because there isn't the opportunities that they need to be involved in. So if there were other things mm-hmm. to get engaged with, you're less likely to delve into those risky behaviors. If there were things in your life that you were going to put at risk because you were involved in that behavior or engaged in that type of opportunity, then perhaps you may not make that same decision if you had it to do all over again.
Okay. Paul?
I think I have to agree with LaShondo that just because you see someone walking down the street doesn't necessarily mean that they don't want to work or they're unemployed. In the Beechwood neighborhood, particularly Parcells Avenue, which runs right through the middle, there are a lot of young people who would love to work. There are no jobs to speak of in the Beechwood neighborhood.
You've talked to them.
Yeah. And I know I've heard on this program multiple times about people trying to take RTS to get to a job at the mall, and it's a huge undertaking. Unfortunately, in our neighborhood, it's more lucrative for young men to stand on the corner and be an entrepreneur, if you know what I mean, then try to go through all of the effort. And it's not that they don't want to go through the effort. It's almost insurmountable in some cases to be able to get to where the jobs exist. So I heartily encourage every business in the region to consider relocating at least some aspect of their jobs within the city confines. It would just make it so much easier for people to get a job.
Okay, Ann?
So our first poverty report talked about multiple different ways people are in poverty. One example was a person who had horrific health care bills. Another one was someone who had lost their job and was downsized and unable to replace that job at the same level. And then there is generational poverty. And in the realm of generational poverty, we do, in some cases, have children who are raising children who are raising children, and we're on a third generation of those supports not being in place. I love the fact that we're looking at community efforts and the holistic approach. But if the data tells us that 47% of single moms in the city are in poverty, and that 41% covers 81% of our kids who are in poverty. So somehow they all got there differently. There's no one answer, as your caller, you know, may say, that these women are by themselves and raising kids. But it's a huge area and an opportunity where we could make significant progress if we can figure out ways to support people in that arena, especially since they cover 81% of our kids in poverty.
One more quick question for the panel before I get back to your phone calls. Kim was mentioning that she, in her perception, 30 years ago, we started, I think she said, praising single moms. Mm-hmm. I mean, what I hear, and maybe I'm wrong, is respect for moms who are doing all the work. You know, it's not like they're a single mom, but dad lives a couple streets over, and he's there and helping out and telling mom, you know, you work and I'll take him for all. I hear praise for single mothers who are doing everything, fighting through poverty. And respect in that position. I don't necessarily, but Kim seems to hear it as sort of a celebration that leads to this dangerous situation where we may be engendering more of that. I mean, LaShonda, what do you think?
Absolutely. I think it's very similar to the concept that if you provide medical subsidy, childcare subsidy, et cetera, that you're enabling people, that they won't want to work hard. They're going to be lazy and stay home and collect welfare. Well, that really just simply... It's not true. I grew up in the inner city around a lot of impoverished people, all who were trying to make it, all who were struggling to maintain their job, struggling to get their kids to school, struggling to make sure that everybody had their needs met in a household. So there really isn't praise. There's, you know, paying homage to the fact that you are able to do it, because many of us, if I had to do it on my own, it would be very, very difficult. So really providing that support and saying, good job is there's absolutely nothing wrong with that, but it's not praise in the way in which the caller has described.
Okay, let me get back to your phone calls, and next we've got John in Webster. Go ahead, John.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You have a good group there. There's nothing being said about the aged for poverty. I spent a year looking for places here in Rochester from the West. And when I finally got interviewed, I came out for an interview and I got a place in a community that was over 62 years of age. And I know lots of people that have not been in that position, and new buildings are built and they immediately have a waiting list of over 200 people trying to get into those buildings. I'll take my comments off the air.
Okay, thank you, John. Thoughts on that from the panel? Paul,
there's a big focus in our community on aging in place and being successful in aging in place. The data, though, if we look at how we would prioritize where we focus, shows that our people who are older do not have near the poverty challenges as others. My sense is part of that is because in our community we have people who retired from large companies who are still getting those types of pensions as well as Social Security. I worry as our younger, after we're past the baby boomers and our younger kids start to age, that they won't have those same supports. But I think part of the lack of availability is that there is not a focus on elderly people being in poverty in the same numbers as others.
I'm thinking of what LaShonda said about some of the stereotypes that, well, if you give someone a medical benefit or some kind of a subsidy, that they they will not want to work. You know, that most people do want to work. Most people want to feel prideful in what they do. And there's probably a non-zero, some small percentage of people who would say, yeah, never work forever. That would be great. Kick up your heels if they'll take care of it. But I think LaShonda's pushing back on some of that. And this is from the New York Times last month. Separate to what Dr. Ben Carson said about poverty generally, he also talked very specifically about housing. The headline being, "Don't make housing for the poor too cozy," Dr. Carson warns. He says he does not like creature comforts for low-income Americans relying on the government for a helping hand. He toured facilities for the poor in Ohio, and Dr. Carson joked that a relatively well-appointed apartment complex for veterans lacked only pool tables. He inquired at one stop whether animals were allowed, and at another, he was happy to hear that officials explaining that they had stacked dozens of bunk beds inside a homeless shelter and purposefully did not provide televisions. His concern being that if you make housing too nice, people will be not incentivized to go get their own housing when they can. I don't know if housing that's too nice in Rochester. I mean, again, maybe I'm missing it. Paul?
Yeah, I don't think that's the case at all. I think the fact that you want to be able to provide somebody with a place that is comfortable enough so that, as LaShonda said earlier, you know, they can have that element of relaxation so that it's not constantly stressed out. You know, some of my neighbors in Beechwood, I mean, huge issues with not only roaches, rats, I mean, the whole gamut. And but those are the places that, however they are subsidized, they are able to afford. And to me, that is not providing an environment where people have the opportunity to flourish.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm just not aware of. And how do you define cushy and cozy? If there's no rats and roaches, is that definitionally cozy all of a sudden? You know, I find it a strange construction. What do you think, LaShonda?
I like to believe that somehow we are misunderstanding what is being said. First of all, it's a humanity issue. I mean, people should be able to live in a place where they feel safe. They should live in a place where they are cool in the summer and warm in the winter time. That's just a human need, a human right. So whether or not something has a level of comfort that one might feel you should be middle class or you should have a certain earning power in order to deserve, I mean, who gets to make those kinds of decisions? It's a little bit absurd to me to think that we have to keep poor people or veterans or any population that needs a subsidy of any kind at a level of discomfort that will make them work harder. We're making the assumption that people who are impoverished and people who are poor because they're lazy. It's equivalent in my mind.
And here's an email that I think will be right in the wheelhouse for Ann Johnson from ACT Rochester and the Rochester Area Community Foundation, who mentioned earlier this hour just the importance of using data. Mm-hmm. Robert says to us, "The problem I often see when discussing poverty is people often present anecdotal examples as empirical evidence. We all have a story of someone abusing food stamps or public assistance, and that somehow trumps the thousands of examples of that not happening. It happens with many complex issues, anecdotal evidence being more important than actual data and empirical evidence." What do you think, Ann?
Absolutely. As we look at the different solutions that we're implementing in our community and the different service providers, they may have different pieces of the holistic puzzle for helping a person, but we have to be sure we're looking at the numbers of what's making a difference. And just because someone is a single head of household with one child, there may be very different supports that would help one of them versus another one. And we tend to have a challenge right now of silo solutions so that we're not able to be person-centered, which is our goal. And yet we need to understand, based on a certain number of indicators, what will work for certain people so we can be smart about it.
I'm going to get back to your phone calls, and I don't know that I've got time to quote from it, but I read and would recommend, if you want to Google an article on this kind of subject, David Denby for The New Yorker last June 2016 wrote a piece called "The Limits of Grit." And it was a bit of a takedown of Angela Duckworth's book, which is called Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance. Denby uses science and some other arguments to say that this is a dangerous way just to put it all on the doorstep of people who have this sort of institutionalized barrier against them in poverty. So it's the article is called The Limits of Grit, and I think it's worth reading. But let me get back to your phone calls. Dave in Rochester next. Go ahead, Dave.
Yes, hello. I think the argument that pull yourself up out of your bootstrappers make doesn't recognize that there's a whole bunch of toxic stress that goes along with poverty. We know that mothers who are single and poor are more likely to be depressed, and then that affects the mental health of their own children. And then anyone who's dealt with someone with depression or who has been depressed, the amount of inertia that they have to overcome to just accomplish the simplest tasks in life can be really overwhelming. Not to mention if you're trying to really pull yourself by your bootstraps. And then, in addition to that, the fact that financial stress can have on IQ. There's a study out there that looked at rice farmers who were getting paid once a year, and I believe it was India. And so when they had their initial payments after harvest, they tested their IQ levels then, and they're actually higher than they were right before harvest when they were at the greatest effect or experiencing the greatest effect of the financial stress. So.
And Dave, just let me just jump in and say I'm not familiar with that study, but I understand the point you're making, and I think I wonder, Paul Whitehouse, if those of us in privilege don't really fully appreciate the day-to-day stress that poverty can bring.
Oh, I don't think we do at all. I mean, I grew up in Webster, middle-class family. Never was even in the neighborhood I now reside in. And we take so much for granted. And I think for myself as a white man, I am so benefited from just how I was born that we do not fully comprehend what so many of our neighbors struggle with day in and day out. And if you are always in survival mode, how in the world can you see past the next 5 minutes?
Let me grab another couple quick phone calls. John in Rochester. Go ahead, John.
Hi, Evan. It's John Andrews calling, and I want to say hello and congratulations to Paul, a neighbor of mine. I'm on
Thank
Grand
you, John.
Avenue, just down the block from 441. And I wanted to just say, as a neighbor from the early 60s, I've been very, very happy with all the things that 441 Ministries have done, started by Chris Holdridge, who is just five houses away from me. And the wonderful sense of community that they bring, the new coffee house that had an open house recently, a wonderful children's program that helps children during the summertime, and, of course, the fresh fruit during the summer that they offer to residents once or twice a week. And I just can't say enough about the great work that 441 Ministries is doing, and hope that they will continue, and they've brought a sense of community back to the neighborhood once again, and it's just a terrific program.
Thank you, John. I know they appreciate that.
John, I was wishing you had been in the booth today. But
it's one of your neighbors. But you know what, though, Paul? To me, that's just an endorsement of real grassroots work that's being done. And before we lose the hour, I should mention, you know, these organizations are probably happy to help you if you want to help them. How can people volunteer if they want to get involved?
If through our website, 441ministries.org, they can connect with me via email on that. We'd be glad to entertain any contacts.
Okay, what about Connected Communities, LaShonda?
Sure, we can be reached at our website, connectedcommunitiesrock, that's ROC.org.
Okay, and Anne, anything you want to share for people to get involved?
Yes, I do. The Ramapi organization has picked three guiding principles that are the basis of moving people out of poverty. And I just want to remind people that if you're not looking at one or some of these to be involved in or to get engaged, structural racism, trauma in someone's lived experience that may be very different than ours, and community building are core to those things that anybody can get involved in and help move us forward. And you can look information up on actrochester.org.
All right. I just want to mention, we're not going to have time to grab Robert in Fairport's call. He wanted to address the single-person household issue, essentially saying one of the roots of the problem is too many single-person households. Wants to hear more about that. Robert, I wish I had more time, but I'll give LaShonda the last word on this because I know you've lived this experience.
Yeah, sure.
And Robert, from his perspective, says We've got to put more emphasis on preventing more of that. What do you think? Hmm.
So preventing single family. I don't know that we will ever get to a place where divorce will never occur or where a single mom will never give birth. But we
teen
do
pregnancy,
teen
right.
pregnancy. I don't know that that would ever eliminate itself. By the way, the highest rate of teen pregnancy occurred in the 1950s. So we actually have declined in terms of teen pregnancy in recent days. However, we can deconcentrate poverty. We can create communities that would provide opportunities for people to be successful regardless of what zip code they're born in.
Well, LaShonda and Paul, thank you for taking the time to come in from your busy schedules and share your thoughts, not only on Dr. Carson's comments, but the broader issues facing our community when it comes to poverty. These conversations will continue, I know, but great having you as always. LaShonda, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And nice to see you. Thank you for being here. And Paul, nice having you here. Thank you.
Thank you, Evan, so much.
All right, short break, much more connections next.